to today's reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette, May 10th, 2024. I'm your reader, Stuart Brahms. Here's our first story from the Mason City Globe Gazette. Eminent domain debate continues, Iowa legislature. Lawmakers, activists vow to revisit restrictions next year after bill fails. Caleb McCullough, Des Moines, Iowa. For the third year in a row, Iowa House lawmakers passed a bill to restrict eminent domain use for carbon capture pipelines during the 2024 session. But the legislation proposing more court oversight of the projects failed to advance in the Senate. The bill was passed as activists opposing the controversial project made frequent trips to the Capitol this year, pushing lawmakers to prevent the involuntary taking of land with compensation for their construction. Those activists and the bill's supporters in the legislature say they expect to keep advocating to pass regulations next year. Two companies, Summit Carbon Solutions and Wolf Carbon Solutions US, have proposed projects that will capture CO2 emitted in ethanol production and send it underground for storage, benefiting from the lucrative federal tax credits and low-carbon fuel markets. A third company, Navigator CO2 Ventures, canceled its planned pipeline last year after facing regulatory hurdles. A portion of landowners along the Summit Pipeline's route, opposed to the use of the eminent domain, have pushed to shut down the project's construction and pressured lawmakers to restrict or outright ban the projects. Wolf Carbon Solutions has said it does not plan to use eminent domain for much of its smaller pipeline. The environmental group, the Sierra Club, has also pushed to stop the projects, viewing them as ineffective solution to climate change that prop up fossil fuels. According to a March Des Moines Register MediaCom poll, 78% of Iowans oppose the use of eminent domain to construct CO2 pipelines. Iowa has existing laws that govern the permitting of carbon dioxide pipelines and allow the use of eminent domain for their construction under certain circumstances. Iowa Utilities Boards has the final say in approving or denying projects. Opponents of the pipelines argue that these laws should be changed because the pipelines are for-profit projects and not public utilities. Supporters of the pipelines, including ethanol and corn growers groups, say the projects are necessary to respond to the growing demand for low-carbon fuels and to allow Iowa ethanol to be used in sustainable aviation fuel. House lawmakers passed a bill this year that would allow a landowner or a company involved in a carbon dioxide capture pipeline proceeding to petition a court to review whether eminent domain is warranted for the project. This bill will also have allowed a person of the group to challenge the IUB's approval of denial pipeline permit without issuing a bond. That bill, House File 2664, passed with overwhelming bipartisan support in the House, 86-7. While it passed out of a subcommittee in the Senate, it was never taken up for the consideration in the Ways and Means Committee. Republicans hold majorities in both chambers. Republican Charlie Thompson, a Republican from Charles City, who managed the bill, said the Senate's inability to pass the bill was a black mark on the chamber. He said landowners who have held out from signing easements with Summit have already suffered harm as they have to wait years to determine whether their land will be taken. We as a state need to step up and make this wrong right, Thompson said. I think it would benefit everybody, including the pipeline folks, to get a rapid determination of whether this is a legal proposal. All but seven House Republicans voted for the proposal, and all Democrats. In the Senate, the bill passed out of a Ways and Means Subcommittee, but it was never taken up for the vote in the full committee. Senate Majority Leader Jack Whitfer, a Republican from Grimes, has said Senate Republicans, who hold 34 of the chamber's 50 seats, have varying opinions on the projects and whether eminent domain restrictions should be passed, which has contributed to the chamber's not voting on any of the House proposals. There are people in our caucus all over the board, he said in an interview before the session began. Some very supportive of the pipeline, some that aren't as supportive of the pipeline. So right now we're kind of split caucus. The pipelines are supported by Iowa's ethanol industry and corn growers. Ethanol industry leaders have said they are necessary for biofuels' continued success as more states and countries demand low-carbon fuels. Tax credits for the sequestration, tough word, it's tax credit credits for the sequestration of carbon dioxide have also been expanded under the law that last two presidential administrations. Senator Jason Schultz and Republican Sheshwig, who ran the Senate subcommittee in support of the bill, said some senators support the project because of that market potential. We have folks who are representing the position of renewable fuels and corn growers that this is absolutely important, Schultz said. I just don't think economic considerations trump property rights, especially when one of these considerations is something as silly as the Green New Deal and its environmental factors like that. House Minority Leader Jennifer Confrist, Democrat of Windsor Heights, said in an appearance on Iowa Press, on Iowa PBS last week, that Democrats have been talking with voters in rural Iowa about eminent domain. She said the focus on the CO2 pipelines has made it difficult to have a broader conversation about the right use of eminent domain. They are sick and tired of corporations coming in and using eminent domain and taking their land, and I think that we are seeing right now is a sort of uprising of a long brewing frustration with corporate interests taking over farmland in this state, Confrist said. Activist elections could change tide. Kim Junker, a Butler County resident who owns land along the proposed summit route, has been pushing lawmakers to restrict the projects for the last 3 years. She said she believes a bill would pass if it is taken up for a vote in the Senate, but there are a few lawmakers who have blocked their passage so far. Junker said she liked the proposal this year to allow court review of the process, especially that piece that eliminated a bond requirement for challenging an IUB decision. This year's election could make a difference in how much support pipeline restrictions have, Junker said. Many of the activists opposing the pipelines are Republicans, and the issue has become a lightning rod in some GOP primary races. Republican Doug Campbell, who was challenging Senate Commerce Committee Chair Waylon Brown in the Mason City area, has made the pipeline issue a central focus of his campaign. We're kind of hoping that there's going to be a little bit of turnover, and maybe that'll send a clear message to some of these legislators that we are not screwing around, Junker said. If you're not going to stand up for our property rights and do what's right, you are going to be out of here. What's next? The Iowa Utilities Board is weighing Summit Carbon Solutions permit application. While there is no set date for a decision, the board could decide before the next legislative session begins. Still, Republican supporters of the legislation say they plan to raise the issue again next year and are hoping they can make more progress. One proposal that was initially included in this year's bill would have allowed around 20% of the members of either the House or the Senate to pause an eminent domain proceeding before the IUB. Thompson said that proposal may come up again, and he said there were other potential policies the House will consider that he declined to share. We're going to keep at it next year, and we have some other things we're going to be doing, he said. I refuse to accept that there is such a supermajority of Iowans are against something that their representative government is not even going to look at it in the form of the Senate. Medicaid coverage extended for moms. Longer postpartum care, a new law, but fewer qualify. Caleb McCullough, Des Moines. New moms in Iowa who qualify for Medicaid will receive 12 months of postpartum care, but fewer people will qualify under the law that Iowa Kim Reynolds signed on Wednesday. The law extends coverage under Medicaid from 60 days required under federal law to 12 months after a woman gives birth. Iowa is one of the last states to enact the extension, which was made available to states under the 2021 American Rescue Plan. The law extends coverage under Medicaid from 60 days to required under federal law to 12 months. The law also tightens the income threshold for a pregnant woman to qualify for Medicaid, meaning around 1,700 fewer mothers and infants will be covered each month. The law will lower the income eligibility to qualify for Medicaid from 375% of the federal poverty line, the most generous in the U.S., to 215% of the poverty line. The new requirement is equivalent to around $43,900 for a single mother and $67,100 for a family of four. Being pro-life means supporting mothers and strong families, Reynolds said, a Republican said in a statement. By extending postpartum Medicaid coverage for thousands of new moms, we will set new families on a path to prosperity and opportunity. Thank you to the legislature for passing this pro-family bill with bipartisan support. The legislation which Reynolds proposed at the beginning of the legislative session was backed by a maternal health care groups and advocates who say providing maternal care for longer will improve outcomes and detection of heart conditions, mental illness, and other problems that can arise months after a person. Spotlight, NASCAR, seeking next superstar. Will NASCAR ever see another Petty or Earnhardt, Gordon or Johnson? Like most sports, NASCAR has been defined by dominant champions. Richard the King Petty ruled the 1960s and 70s, winning 7 Cup championships, a record matched by Dale Earnhardt Sr. during the 1980s and 90s. Jeff Gordon came on to win 4 titles at the turn of the millennium, and Jimmy Johnson joined them atop NASCAR's Mount Rushmore by winning 7 championships, including 5 consecutive titles from 2006 to 2000. But since Johnson's last championship in 2016, no one has stood above the rest and emerged as the transcendent face of NASCAR. In fact, 8 different drivers have accounted for the last 10 championships, and only 2 active drivers, Kyle Busch and Joey Logano, have won multiple titles. Has the day of sports signature driver come to an end? I'll never be bold enough to say that we won't see another Jimmy Johnson, but I'm just going to say we're sure never going to see another driver winning multiple championships like that, said Larry McReynolds, the crew chief of Earnhardt's 1998 Daytona 500 win and now a Fox television analyst. 7 championships is a tall order. Only 3 drivers in history of our sport have ever done that. But to me, the thing that has set Jimmy apart was the 5 in a row when the competition was getting tougher and tougher. All of these different generations of cars and rules changes have come. It's like they were always changing the rules and the format to keep Jimmy from winning, but he and the crew chief, Chance Krause, kept figuring out. The biggest changes were the introductions of new cars, including the Gen 6 car in 2013 and the next-gen car of 2022 and the adoption in 2014 of a 10-race playoff format in which 4 postseason qualifiers were eliminated every 3 weeks until 4 drivers remained for the final race. One poor finish in any of the first 3 rounds of the playoffs could doom a championship contender. Kyle Busch put it best. McReynolds said, with this format, you can win 35 races and not win the championship, because it's about making it to that championship 4 in Phoenix and being good on one day of the race. Johnson won 6 of his titles before the current elimination format. Since the current playoff system started, the back-to-back opportunity has vanished, Johnson said. It's such a volatile system which creates great excitement for the fans, but it doesn't allow the consistency or hot streak that a team might be on during the course of the year to show up in a championship form. The next-gen car in which NASCAR, in an effort to control costs, supplies the race cars, chassis, and parts other than the engines, has succeeded in diminishing a driver or a team's dominance. Of the 83 Cup races since the start of 2022 season, there have been 25 different winners, including the now-retired Kevin Harvick and Kurt Busch, 1 win each. 7 drivers have won the last 12 races of the season. The last few years with the next-gen car have been the biggest change, I would say, says Martin Truex Jr., the 2017 Cup Championship. It has constantly evolved since I came into the sport as far as trying to tighten things up. But the next-gen car just has taken it to a new level. You were talking about everybody having the same parts and pieces, and that has never been a part of the sport. That's definitely a game-changer. Busch, now driving for Richard Childress Racing, after winning his 2 titles for Joe Gibbs Racing, said fans yearn for days of a dominant driver to follow. I'm not sure what it is, but you have the diehard fans of NASCAR, or Jeff Gordon, or Dale Earnhardt, or Rusty Wallace, or Terry Labonte, or Mark Martin, or Harry Gant, you name it. Guys from the 90s, mid-90s, late 90s, all of that, Busch said. Our world now today of 2024 is a lot of fan base, but that's following along. I don't feel like we're able to transition a lot of fans that were fans of those drivers into William Byron fan, into a Kyle fan, or whoever. The kind of all probability that went away just stopped following as much, which is hard to say because honestly, when you look at NASCAR, the fans love the drivers. The driver star power, that's what brings people to the racetrack. 2 drivers who have adapted best to the new cars are Byron, who has won 11 races since the debut of the next-gen car in 2022. Hendrick Motors teammate Kyle Larson with 8. It's been incredible. Gordon, a Hendrick vice president, said of Byron's ascension in the number 24 Chevrolet that Gordon raced the championships. When you look at history and some of the best and best throughout the years, you just don't see anybody with this progression or this path to succeed at this level or this way. Christopher Bell, winner of seven races in 2022, who advanced to the championship four in Phoenix last year, has no problem identifying NASCAR superstars. I would say in my eyes, the superstars in the sport are Kyle Busch, Denny Hamlin, Joey Logano, Brad Keselowski, the guys that have won the most races out of the group, said Bell, driver of the number 20 Joe Gibbs Racing Toyota. I've become harder and harder to do. It's become harder and harder to do that. The days of the big three, Truex, Harvick, and Kyle Busch, are a long way from now. I don't know if we'll ever get it back. There's positives and negatives. We've gotten away from those key guys winning races, but now we have more parity in our sport, and you never know who's going to win going into Sunday. It could be one of 15 to 20 cars. I guess in my eyes, the superstars are the winners and the guys who have won the most, just like Kyle and Dan. Reigning Cup champion Ryan Blaney wonders whether there is any reason to worry about a lack of a true star. We're all superstars, Blaney said. Every driver, everyone is special in their own right. Everyone is successful with how they've approached everything. Some branch out more than others in different aspects outside the racetrack, and some decide to stick around the racetracks and grow their stardom there with the fans at the racetrack. So everyone approaches it differently. Yes, Jeff Gordon through the 90s was the biggest star in anything, but times have changed. You don't have guys winning 10 races anymore. This car doesn't allow that. So how do you separate yourself to make yourself stand out? How do you make yourself different from the rest of the drivers who are really good at what they do? It starts with the success on the racetrack, and then the organizations marketing these drivers, well, how they get where they are, and then the drivers having to be willing to do it and be in the role. You don't need to pluck one out one person. There are a lot of us here, and you can push it. You can make 36 superstars. I think it is definitely. My pet world, addressing destructive behavior. Kathy Rosenthal. Dear Kathy, I have a 3-year-old Maltese Shih Tzu poodle mix. I love her dearly, but she runs around, jumps up, and nips at any object when she gets excited. If she is near the window, she jumps up and bites the vertical blinds, which are already ripped. I had to order a new set of blinds. If she's near the couch, she bites it and has already torn it. This happens whenever people or trucks pass by the house. What can I do to stop her from destroying my house? I've tried giving her chew toys and bully sticks, which she loves, but it has not stopped the bad behavior. Anne from Massapequa, New York. Dear Anne, it sounds like your dog is exhibiting anxiety. I recommend getting a pheromone collar and over-the-counter calming chews and teach your dog the leave it command. Ask your dog to sit. Then put a treat on the floor in front of him and tell him to leave it. When he does, say his reward word or click a clicker to mark the desired behavior. Give him a treat from your hand. Then pick up the treat off the floor. Never let your dog eat the treat off the floor. Repeat this for several times a day for a few weeks. Then your dog gets excited and starts biting something. Tell him to leave it. Also, close the blinds to reduce his triggers. Introduce puzzle toys and play some calming music or white noise to reduce his auditory triggers. Be consistent with training, and he should show improvement in a few weeks. Let me know. Dear Kathy, my kind daughter rescued kittens a few years ago. I took one in, and she has been a wonderful companion. She has a scratch pad with catnip, but instead she shreds curtains, carpets, and furniture. I trim her nails regularly. Bitter apple spray does not work. She's declawing a reasonable option for my indoor cat. I have heard there are techniques that make it less painful. It is not ideal, yet I would adopt more cats if these real issues could be addressed. Julie from Chesterton, Indiana. Dear Julie, I recently addressed this topic on declawing, and while I typically avoid revisiting the same issue so soon, a reader's feedback prompted me to be more empathetic about why it's not a practice I support. Declawing is an antiquated and barbaric procedure. It's illegal in several countries, and for good reason. The procedure involves amputating the last bone of each toe, comparable to removing the tip of your fingers at the last joint. This surgery can lead to a long-term pain and discomfort for your cat. Cats rely on their claws for various natural behaviors, such as stretching, climbing, marking territory. Removing their claws can result in frustration, anxiety, and behavioral changes as they lose their essential outlets for their instincts. Additionally, cats use their claws for defense, and without them they may feel vulnerable and stressed in dangerous situations. Moreover, declawing can alter a cat's gait and balance, potentially causing long-term musculature issues. There are also issues and risks from surgery, including infection, nerve damage, and prolonged healing time. Fortunately, there are numerous alternatives to declawing. Alongside regular nail trimming, introduce your cat to various scratching posts or pads, offering a range of textures and orientations to match their natural scratching preferences. For instance, my cat prefers horizontal scratches. I use catnipper treats to attract them to it, and utilize treats and positive reinforcements to reward them for using it. You can also use deterrents like double-sided tape or aluminum foil on furniture to discourage scratching in undesirable areas. Engage your cat in play sessions 3 or 4 times a day for 10 minutes each to stimulate their natural instincts, provide environmental enrichments, and redirect their energy away from destructive scratching. After a few weeks of consistent training, consider adopting another cat if you like. They may tire each other out for further alleviating this destructive behavior. X etiquette. Often it's just her looking after 5 sons. My husband's sons live with us about 40% of the time, and I have my 3 sons full-time. My husband works in another city during the week, so it is sometimes only me and the 5 boys. Now his ex-wife says we need to have the kids 50-50, and the kids want this as well, and even though my husband is out of town a lot, she still thinks it's his responsibility to take the kids. In reality, it will be me looking after them, and I feel that I am doing as much as I can, so I have refused. Am I being unreasonable? What's good, X? The answer, I always find it amusing when someone asks me if they are being unreasonable, says Jan Blackstone. Has your husband accused you of being unreasonable, or is it the guilt trip you are laying on yourself? I have said many times, if your partner has children, there's always a chance you will end up being a full-time bonus parent. Don't be surprised if down the road that percentage gets even higher. Most of the time, I hear that parents want more time with their kids, and most feel that any additional time should be spent with their birth parent, not the bonus parent. Yet in your case, mom doesn't seem to mind that you are the primary caregiver when the kids are with you. That makes me wonder if she has somehow come into a new life, she wants more free time, or it could be she just needs a breather. Looking outside the box for a solution. 10% is not much more time, and may not just mean dad's weekends don't end up on Sunday, but are extended to Monday morning to school. If that's where the increase comes from, and dad's travels during the week, he could be home on Sunday evening, and it won't just be the kids for you to take the kids. Take care of all of the kids. Sounds to me like you all need to have an honest discussion as to what 10% increase really means. It could end up being insignificant in the big picture, and it could not only make the weekend transition a little easier on the children, but take the burden from you, plus offer dad a little more quality time with his boys. If the boys are approaching middle school or high school, that's the time when children start to gravitate to the same gender parent. That means it may not be his ex, but the boys who want more time with dad. With that in mind, it may be time for dad to take a look at how much time he spends away from home and how it is affecting his relationship with you and his children. More importantly, it's time to take a hard look at your reasons for your refusal. If you are overwhelmed or feel you are being taken advantage of, don't let that fester. Figure out the reason and discuss it openly. You are not the only parent in this scenario. There are 3 parent figures in your bonus families. Everybody should do their part, beginning with the biological parents. Good ex etiquette for parents, rule number 4. Parents make the rules. Bonus parents uphold them. That's good ex etiquette. Welcome to today's reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette and the Fort Dodge Messenger. Today is Friday, May 10th, 2020. I'm your reader, Stuart Brahms. FDCSD levy rate to drop. $69 million budget set for local schools. The property tax rate levied by the Fort Dodge Community School District will go down for the 6th year in a row starting in July. That rate will be $15.19 per year per thousand taxable value when the next fiscal year begins July 1st. In the 2019 fiscal year, it was 16.77 cents per 1,000 of taxable value. It has declined annually since that high mark. The roughly $69 million budget provides money for a 4% raise for teachers, counselors, and school nurses that was included in a recently approved contract with the Fort Dodge Education Association. It also includes sufficient funding to pay for the Dodger Stadium renovation project, which has cash on hand. The budget for the fiscal year that begins July 1st and ends June 30th, 2025, was approved by the district's Board of Education last month. The budget calls for spending $69,187,754. It anticipates revenue of $67,411,741. A sizable portion of the district's revenue, about $23 million, it will come from the state government in the form of what is called state foundation aid. The district gets $7,800 from the state government. The property tax rate is divided into these categories. $8.91 for the general fund, which pays the majority of the district's expenses. $2.48 to pay off general obligation bond debt. $1.21 for the instructional support levy. $1.13 for the management levy, which pays for things like insurance. $1.13 for the physical plant and equipment levy approved by voters. 33 cents for the physical plant and equipment levy implemented by the local school board. That portion of the levy designated for paying off general obligation bonds is being used to retire a 2016 bond, according to Brandel Hansel, an executive director of the financial services for the district. He said that bond issue paid for building the current Tacoma Elementary School and the auxiliary gym at Fort Dodge Senior High School. It also paid for security enhancements at the high school. Hansel said the local school board only controls about 25% of the property tax rate. He said state law dictates about 50% of the rate, which decisions, he said state law dictates about 56% of the rate, while decisions by the voters. In addition to the foundation aid and other money from the state government, the district receives funding from the statewide 1% sales tax for school infrastructure. Hansel said the district will receive $3.8 million from the sales tax in 2024 to 2025. Now arriving, Webster City Railroad history. The five builders of Webster City's railroads are the topic of this year's first history lecture at Mulberry Center Church. Webster City. Think you know your Webster City history? Then surely you know the name Walter Wilson, local landowner and politician. Webster City's best-known hotel, and one of its streets, and the streets are named after him, too. But is there more to the story? Jacob Funks may be on your radar, successful banker and landowner. There's a street on the city's west side named after him. John Duncan, namesake of the erstwhile village just up the Illinois Central from Webster City. Check. John Blair, if you're drawing a blank, and we bet many of you are, you're going to have to come to our lecture to hear the story. We just don't have room here to do him justice. Oh yes, Blairsburg was not named after him, sorry. The fifth of Webster City's railroad builders is one everyone knows, Abraham Lincoln. In the 1850s, while still an attorney and before running for president, he represented the Illinois Central in more than 50 cases. But Mr. Lincoln, Webster City? Dear readers, this is the history, not speculation. Come and listen, be amazed and entertained. Yes, there is a Lincoln connection. Ken Lundy is a self-described amateur historian and railroad enthusiast, a Webster City native. He's done extensive original research for his presentation, The Entrepreneurs and Intrigue Behind Webster City's Railroads. It is the first program in this year's series of free lectures at Mulberry Center Church in Wilson Brewer Park, Webster City. This is also local history at its best. You learn the facts, of course, but more interestingly, the intrigue you will see. It's no coincidence the presentation is taking place on today, or tomorrow, May 11th, National Train Day 2024. Celebrated the Saturday closest to May 10th, the day in 1869 when the first transcontinental railroad was completed at Promontory Point, Utah. It's a day everyone can celebrate their own love of trains. Invented to serve the coal fields and mills of northeastern England, the earliest railroads were primitive affairs, horse-drawn coal cars, were pulled over iron rails crudely fastened to wooden cross ties. Capacities were low, and so were speeds. From that humble beginning now, more than 225 years later, railroads remain important haulers of freight in nearly every country of the world. In a handful of them, bullet trains travel as fast as 275 miles per hour. Very few inventions remain relevant enough to reach their 100th anniversary, let alone surpassing their 200th. No wonder we're still talking about the railroads and celebrating National Train Day. Since the beginning, railroads have evoked admiration and even wonder from onlookers. Ken Lundy is one of them. We asked Lundy how he became a railroad fan. "Not really sure," was his reply. Could the location of the family house on Wood Street, half a block from the IC main line, have been the start of it? Lundy said. "Whenever I heard a train whistle, I just sort of naturally ran towards the tracks. In the 1950s, America trains had everything a young boy wanted. They were big, noisy, powerful, and out in the country, they were fast. According to Lund, once you're hooked, you're hooked. More than 50 years later, he still is. America's railroads looked toward a bright future in the years just after World War II. It was widely acknowledged the nation's railroads played a crucial role in winning the war. Heavy freight trains pounded the rails day and night to deliver the critical goods needed by both the United States and Allied forces, an unending stream of goods produced by what Eisenhower called the arsenal of democracy. At the peak of wartime demand, 1944, more than 72% of all freight traffic moved by rail. Similarly, more than 75% of all commercial passenger movement during the war was by rail, including an almost unbelievable 97% of all military personnel. At some point, Lundy discovered a world of railroading beyond Wood Street. Just a dozen blocks to the east, in the central Webster City, stood the Illinois Central Depot, the CNNW Depot, Interlocking Tower, the busy track serving the Franklin Laundry and Morton Foods plants, and public team tracks, where freight cars were switched by loading and unloading by firms that didn't have private spurs of their own. Seemingly everywhere the young Ken Lindley looked at Webster City, he saw trains at work. IC passenger trains handled large volumes of mail and express traffic, as well as passengers destined to Waterloo, Dubuque, Rockford, Illinois, and Chicago to the east, and Fort Dodge, Storm Lake, Cherokee, and Sioux City to the west. Downtown merchants still received merchandise by express or less than carload freight service. Local hatcheries, and there were several, shipped live baby chicks to markets across the country. The IC switched carloads of coal into the city of Webster City's electrical utility plant. The great Chicago catalog merchants, Sears, Ward's, Alden's, and Spiegel, all shipped most orders by Railway Express Agency. Long before FedEx or UPS, it was the familiar red and green railway express trucks that pulled up to your house. And the express man not only delivered, he would pick up shipments at your front door as well. No need to go downtown to the depot. Western Union delivered telegrams all over town. Lundy might have already been hooked, but his love of trains was destined to intensify. My dad, Harold Lundy, was a warehouse foreman at Brin's Furniture Store. After school, I'd go downtown, wait for Dad to get off work, and we'd ride home together. The store, which for years advertised its location as around the corner on Seneca Street, was also close to a railroad, this time the Chicago and Northwestern. Brin's received most of its new furniture by the boxcar load, probably from factories in the southeast, where most furniture was and still is manufactured. Now, picture the nightly eastward passage of Illinois Central's lordly eastbound Hawkeye due to make its brief stop in Webster City. Just about 10:30 p.m., the atmosphere on the depot platform was almost magical. First, the locomotive headlight appeared far to the west. Icy passenger engines had two headlights, one fixed and the other a sweeping Mars light piercing the gloom. As the train whistled for Grove Street crossing, people hurried out of the depot into the platform. The heavy express wagons were trundled out to the exact place the express and baggage cars would come to rest, all under cover of night, and with the steam from underneath the cars swirling everywhere. But Lundy and his father weren't at the depot just to see the train come in. Oh, no. They were there on business. My mother raised Siamese kittens and sold them to a pet shop in Chicago. Dad and I took them down to the depot in baskets where they were put aboard the express car on their eastbound Hawkeye. Dad slipped the expressman a few dollars to ensure the cats were fed and warded on the way to Chicago. Hooked, you ask? Who wouldn't be? Lundy's research for the presentation is full of politicians, lawyers, and entrepreneurs, building railroads, as he says, with other people's money. In every aspect of Webster City's history, he noticed the same names kept coming up again and again and again. Come in and hear how their stories are connected to create much of Webster City we see and know today. Brushing off all the work that went into the presentation, Lundy told the Daily Freeman Journal, "It's a great story, and one I hope all Webster citizens can connect to." The presentation is on Saturday, May 11th at 1:30 p.m. at Mulberry Center Church, Wilson Brewer Historic Park. corner of Superior and Ohio Streets. There is no charge, but a free will offering is welcome. For those unable to make the lecture itself, Lundy will be in the depot from 10 a.m. Saturday morning until the presentation at 1:30, then afterwards until about 4 p.m. In Fort Dodge, go and do. Fort Dodge, Webster City County Health Department is partnering with the Iowa Total Care and Hy-Vee for Community Connection Wellness Bash from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. Saturday at Athletics for Education and Success, 712 3rd Street Northwest Green. Green to Grow program will give away 10,000 pieces of fresh produce to community members. There will also be shelf-sustainable foods, family giveaways, family activities, and more. Fort Dodge. Fort Dodge Parks and Recreation is holding National Bicycle Month Glow Ride from 7:30 to 9 p.m. Saturday at the Olison Park Music Pavilion. There will be 2K and 5K rides. There will be glow sticks and zip ties to decorate your bike. First come, first serve. Fort Dodge. Celebrate Mother's Day in downtown Fort Dodge beginning at 10 a.m. Saturday. There will be vendors, crafts, food trucks, and activities. There will be free kids' crafts from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. Fort Dodge. A free meal will be held at the First United Methodist Church, 127 North 10th Street, from 5 to 7 p.m. on Saturday. The menu includes smoked pork loin, baked beans, salads, dinner roll, chips, drinks, and dessert. There will be a bingo game for adults after the meal with the prizes. Around the area. The State in History, Associated Press. Today is Friday, May 10th, the 131st day of 2024. There are 235 days left in the year. Today's highlights. On May 10th, 1940, during World War II, German forces began invading the Netherlands, Luxembourg, Belgium, and France. The same day, British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain resigned, and Winston Churchill formed a new government. On this date, in 1775, Ethan Allen and his Green Mountain Boys, along with Colonel Benedict Arnold, captured the British-held fortress at Ticonderoga, New York. In 1818, American patriot Paul Revere died in Boston at the age of 83. In 1865, Confederate President Jefferson Davis was captured by Union forces in Irwinville, Georgia. On this date, in 1869, a golden spike was driven in Promontory Point, Utah, marking the completion of the first transcontinental railroad in the United States. Today's birthdays. Author Barbara Taylor Bradford is 91. Actor David Clennon is 81. Writer-producer, director Jim Abrahams is 80. Singer Donovan is 78. Singer-songwriter Graham Gouldman is 78. Singer Dave Mason is 78. Sports anchor Chris Berman is 69. Actor Bruce Penhall is 67. Former Senator Rick Santorum of Pennsylvania is 66. Senator Cindy Hyde Smith of Mississippi is 65. Actor Victoria Rowell is 65. And rock singer Bono is 64. In brief, guns are being stolen from cars at triple the rate they were 10 years ago. Washington. The rate of guns stolen from cars in the United States has tripled over the last decade, making them the largest source of stolen guns in the country. An analysis of the FBI data by the gun safety group Everytown found. The rate of stolen guns from cars climbed nearly every year and spiked during the coronavirus pandemic, along with a major surge in weapons purchased in the United States, according to the report, which analyzes FBI data from 337 cities in 44 states and was provided to the Associated Press. The stolen weapons have in some cases turned up at crime scenes. In July 2021, a gun taken from an unlocked car in Riverdale, Florida, was used to kill a 27-year-old Coast Guard member as she tried to stop a car burglary in her neighborhood. The alarming trend underscores the need for Americans to safely secure their firearms to prevent them from getting into the hands of dangerous people, said Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives Director Steve Dettelbach, whose agency has separately found links between stolen guns and violent crimes. People don't go to a mall to steal a firearm from a locked car to go hunting. These guns are going straight to the street, said Dettelbach, whose agency was not involved in the report. They're going to violent people who can't pass a background check. They're going to gangs. They're going to drug dealers. And they're going to hurt and kill the people who live in the next town, the next county, or the next state. Video shows Florida deputy announced himself prior to fatal shooting of black airman. Fort Walton Beach, Florida, Associated Press. A Florida sheriff's deputy announced himself as law enforcement just before fatally shooting a black U.S. Air Force airman inside his apartment in the state's panhandle, according to body camera video shown to reporters Thursday. Oskaloosa County Sheriff Eric Aiden presented the video hours after the family of senior airman Roger Fortson and their attorneys held a news conference in which they disputed that the deputy acted in self-defense. Aiden rejected assertions made by civil rights attorney Ben Crump, who was representing Fortson's family, that the deputy had gone to the wrong apartment, covered the door's peephole, and did not announce himself. The video shows the deputy arriving at Fort Walton Beach apartment building on May 3rd and speaking to a woman outside who described hearing an argument. The deputy then went up on an elevator and walked down an outdoor hallway. The video shows the deputy banging on the door and stepping aside, seemingly out of the view of the door. Twice he shouted, "Sheriff's office, open the door." Fortson opened the door and could be seen holding what appeared to be a handgun pointed down towards the floor. The deputy shouted, "Step back," and fired off shots. He then shouted, "Drop the gun, drop the gun." Harvey Weinstein won't be sent back to California while awaits trial in rape. New York waits. Harvey Weinstein won't be sent back to California while he awaits New York rape retrial. New York, Associated Press. Harvey Weinstein will remain locked up in New York as a court works out whether he should stay in a city jail while awaiting trial or be sent to California to serve his prison sentence for rape. The fallen movie mogul, who showed up for the hearing in a wheelchair and wearing a dark suit, did not consent to California's extradition request during a brief court hearing Thursday. The 72-year-old will remain behind bars at Rikers Island Jail, where he was returned to from a city hospital just days ago. California now needs to produce a warrant signed by the governor with 90 days, Judge Joanne Waters said. They are not in a position to extradite Mr. Weinstein because they have not done what they need to do, Diana Fabi Sampson, Weinstein's lawyer, said outside court following the appearance. Obituaries. Diane Spangler, Eagle Grove, service Monday, May 13th, 11 a.m. at Faust Funeral Home in Eagle Grove, with visitation from 10 a.m. until service time at the funeral home. David Halder, Livermore, services are currently pending. Lentz Funeral Home of Livermore is assisting the family. Wanda Liu, Rowayne, funeral will be held 2 p.m. Monday, May 13th at the Ewing Funeral Home in Clarion. Visitation will be 1 hour. To the Stags, ready for state tourney, Pleasant Hill, Fort Dodge has both the pressure and the privilege of being a team to beat in Friday's Iowa State Rugby Championship. Stags head coach Tom McClim wouldn't want it any other way. The number 2 seed in Class 2A bracket, Fort Dodge, 11-1 overall, rides an 11-match win streak into the competition at Southeast Polk High School. The Stags take on 7th seed Urbandale at 6:40 p.m., with the winner squaring off against either Waverly Shell Rock or Des Moines Lincoln in the semifinals. It's going to be a tough task to win the whole thing, but I think our guys have put in the time and they put themselves in a position where it can be done. Southeast girls earned 4 automatic bids. Earlham. Maria Myers was a double event winner once more, and Josie Harvey joined her as an individual automatic state qualifier here Thursday for the St. Edmunds girls track and field team. Myers swept the discus and shot put during a Class 1A district meet, with Harvey placing first in the 100 hurdles. Winners from each event earn bids to the state meet, which begins next week in Des Moines. Earlham. The St. Edmunds boys put together a strong performance here Thursday night in Class 1A state track and field qualifier. While the Gales did not earn any automatic bids with top finishes, they had several marks. They put them in consideration for the larger spots. The winners of each event from each district around the state advance to Des Moines and Drake Stadium next week, with the top 14 next filling out the field. Tritons rally to survive in Region 11 tourney. A 5-run seventh helped lift the 4th-ranked Iowa Central baseball team past North Iowa after Thursday's afternoon's 8-5 win. With this win, the Tritons, 45-11 overall, advance in the Region 11 tournament to meet number 10 Southeastern, 41-15, back here at Rogers Park, Friday at 11 a.m., Southeastern earned a bye into the semifinals. Will Smoot hit a home run with Michael Seamer driving a 3-run lead to the Iowa Central offense. Cooper Nicholson and Smoot both had 2 RBIs, while Zachary Goodwin had 2 hits and scored twice. An ugly win is better than a pretty loss, ICCC head coach Eric Stein said. We had a lot of chances all day, and I'm just glad that we finally won it. Community calendar. Today, Blandon Memorial Art Museum, 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. Admission is free. Saturday, Mother's Day, downtown Fort Dodge, 10 a.m. downtown, free. Webster County Health Department Wellness Bash. Blandon Memorial at 712 3rd Street Northwest. Community meal, 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. The First United Methodist Church at 127 North 10th Street. Bingo with prizes will be held after the meal, no charge. In brief, flood watch for Stratford. A flood watch has been issued for the Des Moines River near Stratford, according to the National Weather Service. The watch will be in effect from this afternoon until 1 a.m. Saturday. The watch means flooding is possible. At 10 a.m. Thursday, the river near Stratford will be at 17.3 feet. Flood stage is considered to be 19. The warning for northern Humboldt County along the east fork of the Des Moines River has been extended until Monday. The warning for southern Humboldt County has been extended through Tuesday. Reynolds signs law expanding postpartum Medicaid coverage, restricting eligibility. Governor Kim Reynolds has signed several bills from the 2024 legislative session into law, including measures to extend postpartum Medicaid coverage and set new early literacy standards. The governor signed Senate file 2251 into law Wednesday. The new law will extend Medicaid coverage for new and expecting mothers from its previous 60-day limit to over 1 year, a provision followed under the 2021 federal COVID-19 pandemic emergency plan beginning in 2025. The law extends the duration of available postpartum Medicare coverage for the Iowa mothers and infants, but limits eligibility for the benefits. The new law lowers the income limits for the families to 215% or below the federal poverty line, meaning a family of four making roughly $64,500 annually or less, and a single mother and infant making $43,900 or less would qualify. This restriction represents a drop from the 375% income level limit for coverage. While Democrats have called for Republicans to adopt postpartum Medicaid expansion, members of the minority party criticized Reynolds and Republicans for the income restriction and floor debate in the 2024 measure. On the 2024 measure, according to the analysis for the legislative services agencies, the income restrictions will mean that each month roughly 1,300 mothers and 400 infants were eligible under the previous limit will not have Medicaid coverage. But Republicans argued on the floor debate that keeping the previous income limit at 375% of the poverty line would cost the state $6.2 million per year. Senator Mark Costello, Republican from Imogene, said in a subcommittee meeting that the 215% FPL limit is still above the average 210% income cutoff among the 47 states that are participating in the Medicaid expansion. Mazie Stilwell, with Planned Parenthood Advocates of Iowa, said in a statement on the law signing, while she was happy to see the coverage extended, the income limitations hurts Iowans. That brings to the end of today's reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette and the Fort Dodge Messenger. I'm your reader, Stuart Brahms. Thank you for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. A decade ago, there were typically 20 earthquakes a year that were large enough to feel in the central and eastern U.S. But in 2015, there were over 1,000 of them. Why? It's mostly because we're pumping more water into the ground. The boom in U.S. oil and gas production over the last decade has brought many more oil wells, which also produce water. Most is naturally occurring in the formation, and some was injected by operators to allow or improve the recovery of oil and gas. In both cases, the water will likely have picked up salt and other minerals from the rock, making it many times saltier than seawater. Operators may re-inject this water to continue to liberate oil and gas. But more often, there's too much to handle, so it's trucked or piped to disposal wells, where it's pumped down into deep saltwater reservoirs. Adding large volumes of wastewater increases the pressure in these rock formations, which can allow natural faults to slip more easily than they normally would, causing earthquakes. To address these quakes, regulators and the petroleum industry are monitoring disposal wells and shutting down those that could cause damaging seismic activity. And they now think that managing wastewater injection more carefully should help. There's still more work to be done, and university research centers, like the Bureau of Economic Geology, are conducting major studies with the aim of minimizing the risk of earthquakes while maintaining the benefits of domestic energy production. For Earth Date, I'm Scott Tinker.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.
In the People's Pharmacy Health Headlines, at high doses, nonsteroidal anti-inflammatory drugs like diclofenac, ibuprofen, or naproxen may increase the risk of kidney problems. The study that revealed this used de-identified medical records of more than 750,000 active duty U.S. Army soldiers. Consequently, these were active young and middle-aged adults. During the time of the study, from 2011 through 2014, nearly 18% of these soldiers got a prescription for 1 to 7 doses of an NSAID pain reliever in a month. Another 16% were prescribed more than 7 doses in a month. Fewer than 1% of these people were subsequently diagnosed with acute or chronic kidney disease. Nevertheless, the rate of kidney trouble was about 20% higher among people who had received high-dose NSAIDs than among those who had taken none. The authors described the increased risk as modest but statistically significant.
Another class of drugs that can lead to kidney injury is proton pump inhibitors. A data mining initiative of the FDA's Adverse Event Reporting System analyzed kidney-related side effects among 43,000 people who took a drug such as esomeprazole, lansoprazole, or omeprazole. Approximately 8,000 people taking a histamine 2 blocker such as ranitidine or famotidine served as controls, since they take these drugs for similar symptoms. The researchers found that 5.6% of people on PPIs alone had a kidney-related side effect, while only 0.7% of those on H2 blockers did. Chronic kidney disease was 28 times more likely, and acute kidney injury was 4 times more likely among people taking PPIs. While this analysis shows association, not causation, there are previous studies linking PPIs and kidney damage.
There's growing concern about a mysterious infectious disease that has been spreading among the wild deer population for decades. Scientists call it CWD, or chronic wasting disease. Hunters refer to this condition as zombie deer disease. It can also affect elk and moose. The CDC reports that this infectious disease has spread to wildlife in 24 states and 2 Canadian provinces. CWD was first detected in Colorado among captive deer in the 1960s and in the wild deer population in the 1980s. It's now affecting deer in the Midwest, Southwest, and some parts of the East Coast. The disease appears to be caused by a prion infection reminiscent of mad cow disease. An infectious disease expert at the University of Minnesota has warned that hunters who eat contaminated deer meat may eventually develop the human equivalent of chronic wasting disease.
Shoulder replacement surgery is becoming increasingly common. Now researchers writing in the BMJ say that patients should be warned that the risks are higher than originally thought. The investigators reviewed hospital and mortality records in the UK. When men between 50 and 59 have this type of shoulder surgery, one in four will need further surgery on that shoulder within 5 years. In addition, older people who underwent this kind of surgical procedure experienced high rates of serious adverse events. One in nine older women and one in five older men had an infection, major blood clot, heart attack or stroke, or died within 3 months. The authors of the study encouraged their colleagues to counsel patients about the risks as well as the benefits of this kind of surgery.
Drug interactions are a serious hazard in hospitals and the community. If patients receive prescriptions for incompatible medications, they can experience severe side effects that may even be life-threatening. Electronic medical records are intended to warn prescribers and pharmacists about potentially dangerous interactions, but many do so indiscriminately. The result is something called alert fatigue. If clinicians receive too many warnings, they may not pay attention to the really important ones. A team at St. Jude Children's Research Hospital reviewed their alert system. They removed unnecessary alerts and provided additional information to the most important ones. After they finished, they tracked clinicians' reactions. Alert overrides dropped by 40%. One important change linked alerts to the patient's laboratory data, making them much more targeted. And that's the health news from the People's Pharmacy this week.